Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. A new television talent is born tonight when HBO debuts Glickman, highlighting one of the all-time great talents in sportscasting. James Freeman, the program's producer, writer, and director, joins me next. Surviving Evil, coming to Investigation Discovery Wednesday night, highlights people turning the tide against their attackers or abductors. The series host, former Buffy the Vampire Slayer co-star Charisma Carpenter, is the opening subject. We'll speak with producer Jeff Vanderwall later this hour. Also ahead, our classic trivia question of the week, plus some thoughts on a pair of actors passing on, and last night's MTV Video Music Awards, and I promise you, no Miley Cyrus. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, live from New York on Block Talk Radio. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Last Monday of August 2013, welcome to the program that covers the world of television. Glad that you could spend your Monday afternoon with us. 83 degrees at the top of the hour here in New York, and we invite you to be part of the program over the next hour and change. Pair of great guests for you, and the way you get involved is giving us a call. The number you use is 1-646-652-2906. That's 1-646-652-2906. That number is good anywhere you are catching us across the country or around the world here on Blog Talk Radio. Another way to get involved is our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. So either way, phone a chat room. We appreciate what you have to say. And while the program is on the air, you can connect with others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk Radio screen, follow the instructions, and other people can hear this show live with you. Over the years, Home Box Office, HBO, has presented a number of documentaries on some of the great radio and television sportscasters of all time. There was the documentary on Jim McKay, the former host of ABC's long-running Wide World of Sports, and the documentary by Howard Cosell, television's first controversial sports commentator and analyst. Tonight, that tradition continues with Glickman, the story of a great track and field athlete who had a setback by not competing in the 1936 Berlin Olympics because of his creed. But he went on to become one of the great radio and television sportscasters and influenced many of the sportscasters here today, from Marv Albert to Bob Costas. The program is executive produced by Martin Scorsese, who says, and I quote, "Glickman captures the nobility and excitement of Marty himself, inventive, accessible, and voracious. A New York staple who ignited sports and taught America the only way to experience the games." The program premieres tonight at 9 o'clock on HBO and will be repeated the next few weeks on both HBO and HBO 2. My first guest is making his television debut with this documentary special as writer, producer, director, and yes, even the narrator. Joining us live from Los Angeles, James Friedman. James, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Simon. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure to have you on, James. Of all the things you could do to start off your television career, why this special and why focus on Marty Glickman?
Well, I actually had a television career as a writer, but this is certainly my first film. Many years ago, I used to work for Marty. When I was 17, I produced his late-night talk show on WNEW, one of the first all-sports call-in shows in the nation. I actually got that job. I used to drive into New York with my brother and watch him produce it. He got called up to the Army Reserves and told Marty he'd have to find another producer. Without missing a beat, Marty Glickman pointed directly into the booth at me and said Jimmy could do it. I literally turned around expecting to see another guy named Jimmy sitting there. For the rest of that year, he taught me how to produce his show, screen calls, schedule commercials, get the scores off the wire. It was pretty heady stuff for a 17-year-old kid. I've been telling this story as I've been promoting the film this week, and I often am asked, weren't you intimidated working for Marty Glickman at that young age? And I say no, because Marty never treated me as a high school kid. He always treated me as his producer, and it gave me a professional confidence I have to this very day.
How much of the misfortune that Glickman had when he was a track and field star, what happened to him being not allowed to compete in the 1936 Berlin Olympics because of being Jewish, along with another athlete that was also going to be on the team, how much of that influenced not only getting into sportscasting and the kind of sportscaster he was, but for example, just now, as you said, how he treated you?
Well, Marty Glickman was the definition of the word mensch. I mean, he reached out to so many people, not just helping broadcasters, and he mentored a who's who of broadcasters, Marv Albert, Bob Costas, at one point Kurt Gowdy for your older listeners. The list goes on and on. But he also reached out to kids in the New York City high schools doing the high school game of the week, and working with the Police Athletic League. This guy did an enormous amount to help the youth in New York City. In terms of it affecting his broadcasting, I don't believe that event affected his broadcasting, but it did do this. Marty Glickman believed in the joy of sport. And by that I mean, you know, it was almost primal. You're having a catch with your son. That feeling you get emanated out of a Marty Glickman broadcast. And I think what happened to him, where he was denied the chance to run in the 1936 Berlin Olympics with another Jewish runner, Sam Stoller, affected him in a way that he wanted that to never happen to anyone again. And I think that's why he reached out to so many people, and you know, it, and why he wanted to overcome that. And you know, really, because of that incident, I realized the threat of my film, the heart of it, is what happens when an 18-year-old's dreams are crushed by racism and prejudice. Do they become bitter, or do they triumph in life? Well, Marty Glickman not only triumphed, but he used sports as a means of transcending those divisions created by race, class, and religion. This was a very, very special man.
He was so special that he also transcended being sort of pigeonholed as being popular in one kind of sport or showcasing one kind of sport. A lot of people here in New York know him, of course, for all the many years he did the New York Giants and then the New York Jets football games on radio. But he was as versatile, perhaps, a sportscaster as anyone else who ever did the job.
He was brilliant at broadcasting a game with movement, football, basketball. And, in fact, your listeners probably don't know this, Marty Glickman literally revolutionized radio basketball play-by-play, coining many of the terms broadcasters use today, and they don't even know where they came from. It was almost as if he wrote the NBA dictionary, creating such terms as the key, the lane, the midcourt stripe, and his most famous, swish. But what he really did was he gave listeners the geography of the court. Prior to Marty Glickman, this is what a radio basketball play-by-play broadcast sounded like. You know, he would say, Smith passes to Jones, Jones shoots and scores. You wouldn't know where anyone was. Marty Glickman, by giving the geography of the court, would say, Smith dribbles up along the right sideline, throws a behind-the-back bounce pass to the top of the key to Jones. Jones pump fakes, drives across the lane, and banks in a running one-hander. You saw the game. Mike Breen had a great quote. He said it was as if Marty's voice was attached to the ball. And Larry King had another great quote. It was like he was television on radio.
And what was your contribution to television as a sportscaster?
Well, Marty never really got that national exposure, which television gives you. Radio does not. And he had a shot. He was the national broadcaster for the NBA Games of the Week in the early 50s, the mid-50s. But keep in mind, basketball at that time was almost like a minor league sport. And he chose to go into basketball because no one really was doing it, and he felt he could be and was a pioneer in that sport, broadcasting. And he was the broadcaster for the NBA Game of the Week, and the NBA and NBC wanted a more Midwestern presence. They didn't want such a New York-sounding announcer. Some people say that's euphemistic for too Jewish, but the bottom line is you have to put it in the perspective of the times. There were no national ethnic broadcasters. In fact, there are very few today. You don't hear many Southern accents, Italian accents on national broadcasters. And for Marty Glickman, he, you know, it was a situation where that was the era where every movie star, you know, Dean Martin was Dino Crosetti. Everybody changed their name. Well, Marty Glickman was very proud of being Jewish and didn't want to change his name. He said he didn't want his father to turn on a broadcast of his and hear his son saying, this is Marty Manning, or whatever made-up name he would have come up with. And it actually did hurt him, and he did not get that national presence that he wanted, and he watched many others get it. I mean, the first known Jewish broadcaster on a national level was probably Howard Cosell in the 70s, 20 years later. But, you know, that definitely affected him. And, in fact, a major reason I made this film is that, you know, I moved to the Midwest for college and later settled in California and Los Angeles. And people would say, you know, what's the greatest job you ever had? And I would so proudly say, I produced Marty Glickman's talk show when I was in high school. And they'd say, who's Marty Glickman? Because outside of New York, very few people knew him. And it, well, to say nothing of his incredible life story. And I always felt that this film could remedy that even a little. It will have been a success.
And that life story, which is written, produced, and directed, and narrated by our guest, James Freeman, is Glickman. It premieres tonight on HBO. It's executive produced by Martin Scorsese. Very rare documentary effort, particularly in the sports arena for Mr. Scorsese. The program premieres tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time. It will be repeated over the next few weeks in primetime and other day parts on both HBO and companion channel HBO2. James Freeman joins us live from Los Angeles this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. Simon Applebaum on the other coast, New York, live on Block Talk Radio this Monday afternoon. We invite you to be part of the program. Give us a call at 1-646-652-2906 or check out our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. We have guest 1310 and our good friend from Philly, Rick Rev, in the room. Coming up Friday on the program, Renee Lawless. She is a co-star of one of the hot shows of this summer, Tyler Perry's first drama for television, The Have and the Have-Nots, running Tuesday nights on the Oprah Winfrey Network. On the second half of the hour, we will feature a new network that you can only get on your smart TV or through over-the-top devices like Roku. It's called Evox Television, and it deals with sustainable living. Could this network do what Planet Green could not do? We'll talk to the Chief Executive Officer, Zob Dabog. That's coming up Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio. When you decided to go forward with this project, James, was it just going to be as a writer? How did the other talents, producing and directing, come into play?
You know, the directing part is very small. The producing part is enormous because you have to – the best thing I did about choosing my first subject and having it be Marty Glickman is that, you know, I wasn't anybody to these people I called. And the people in the film, for your listeners, we're talking about Marv Albert, Bill Bradley, Mike Breen, Jim Brown, Bob Costas, Frank Gifford, Jerry Stiller, Larry King, David Stern, Elliot Gould, Oscar Robertson. I could go on more and more. They would hear I'm doing a documentary on Marty Glickman and say, where do you want me? Where do you want me to when do you want me to show up? That was how beloved this man was. The negative side of it from a producing standpoint is I had to find 70 years of footage from the 1930s to 2000. And people say, how long did it take to make the film? I said, it took a year to make and 2 years to find and then beg for free footage. But I did find it, and the producing part is much more of an enormous task than the writing and directing. There is one thing I did do, though, people said, ask, how did working for Marty Glickman affect the way you did this film? Well, Marty was, when he mentored and taught sports broadcasting, he was almost a professor of sports broadcasting, to be honest. He couldn't stand when announcers talk too much. He said, you know, he had a famous line, the only one who tunes in to hear the broadcaster is the broadcaster's mother. You know, all he wanted was sparse language, economy of words, great feeling. And so when I wrote the narration for this film, I wrote it with Marty in my ear, you know, cut that word, say it shorter. Get right to the point. Let the listener know exactly what you want to say and move on. Very specific. And it makes the film, I think, you know, crisper and with even more vibrant, which was a quality that Marty certainly had in his broadcast.
What was easier to get, Glickman's radio broadcast or his television work?
Boy, everything was difficult to get, to be honest. You know, you just have to keep exploring. The most difficult stuff to do was to find the races he ran as a high school kid. There was a guy at Paramount Newsreels, and, you know, these archivists are some of the most wonderful people because they are protecting the history of the organizations they work for. And he said, look, I found this videotape. I'm going to send it to you. It's very snowy. You can barely make out anyone. It's labeled 1936 in a New York high school race. Maybe Marty Glickman is in it, but you couldn't make it out. I lived with this thing for 6 months, hoping and praying it was him. And then I got to transfer the 35-millimeter nitrate film print that they used to use many years ago, the stuff that blows up in the lab. It's so fragile. And sure enough, there's Marty Glickman winning – a race in high school that is so crystal clear and so beautiful. I mean, it's like hitting the lottery when you go on, you know, these scavenger hunts for footage. There's another situation that I came across, the Hearst newsreels, and they show the 500 U.S. Person delegation arriving in Berlin for the 1936 Olympics, which I'm sure we'll get into in a few minutes. And sure enough, on one of the buses coming in is a one-second shot of Marty Glickman and Sam Stoller. So I literally could show the viewer placing Marty Glickman arriving in Berlin for those Olympics that he sadly never got a chance to run in.
Before I get into that subject, I wanted to ask you about how HBO got involved. I'm curious whether, because they had done the documentaries earlier on Jim McKay and Howard Cosell, where they were like the natural first place to go, and how did Martin Scorsese get involved as the executive producer?
Okay, to answer your first question, when I was doing the interview of Ross Greenberg, who at the time was the head of HBO Sports, he later left, you know, he was mentored by Marty, and I always felt I certainly had a receptive person there when I finished the documentary, but I did not deal with anyone at HBO. Later, my film played the Santa Barbara Film Festival, and I got a call from several people in Hollywood who run studios, and also from Ari Emanuel, the head of William Morris Endeavor, who asked if he could see the film. I sent it to him, and 1 week later, I was sitting in his office, and he said, "You know who should see this film? Martin Scorsese." I'm sitting there going, "Martin Scorsese? Yeah, sure, if he must, sure, let him see the film. That sounds good." 2 days later, I received an email from Marty saying he loved the film and wanted to release it through his company on HBO. So pretty much a typical Tuesday in my life.
With the situation with the Berlin Olympics, there are so many ironies in this. One, obviously, with the fact that Jesse Owens ran in that and Glickman did not, because of the Jewish. But also, what really surprised me personally is that the person who made the decision to have both Glickman and the other athlete not take part was Avery Brundage, who at the time was the head of the U.S. Olympic Committee and then later on became the head of the International Olympic Committee and was in charge of the 1972 Munich Games, which may go down as the worst Olympics ever.
Yes, it's well, you're bringing up a whole range of subjects there. It's beyond sad that this man, in 1972, he was the head of the International Olympic Committee and would not stop the games after the Israeli athletes were killed. By the way, in 2012, they wanted a moment of silence to, you know, remember those athletes because it was the 40-year anniversary, and they were turned down again. They, during the opening ceremonies, they did not get that moment of silence. In terms of in 1936, different people have different points of view of exactly what happened, and it is many years ago. Some people believe track politics was the reason Marty and Sam Stoller were replaced. The assistant track coach, Dean Cromwell, had his two USC runners that were put in the race, and Glickman and Stoller had beat both of those guys in practice that week, but they were put over him. And others believe Avery Brundage, who later was proven to be a Nazi sympathizer, was pulling the strings behind the scenes because he did not want Adolf Hitler to suffer watching two Jewish athletes on the victory stand. And keep in mind this, for your listeners, this was the Nazi Olympics of 1936, where Hitler was espousing the myth of Nazi Aryan supremacy, only to watch the incredible great black athletes of the United States, led by Jesse Owens, Ralph Metcalf, John Woodruff, Archie Williams, just smash to smithereens and crush this myth. Well, the next scheduled race was a 400-meter relay, and it was which Marty and Sam Stoller were scheduled to run, and it was said we were so favored to win that event by 15 yards. You know, they said the only way we'd lose was if we dropped the baton. It was that much of a foregone conclusion that two Jewish runners would be on the victory podium. They were called in, the sprinters were called into a meeting the morning of the day of the race and said the Germans were hiding their best sprinters, hiding world-class sprinters to upset the American team. It was so clearly a lie because, number one, you cannot hide world-class sprinters. They had to have run to become world-class sprinters. And Marty and Sam Stoller did not get a chance to run. and in fact never got a chance to run because World War II happened, and in 1940 and 44 there were no Olympics. So this opportunity was taken away from them forever. To add, the reason I come down on the side of what Marty Glickman believes, that it was anti-Semitism, is 2 years after the Olympics, when the Nazis were building the German embassy in Washington, D.C., they awarded that construction contract to Avery Brundage's company. That certainly seems like a thank you to me.
Was there a particular thing that Glickman wanted to do, either in radio or television, that for some reason or other he could not attain for all the great accomplishments that he had?
Well,
was there a particular
national presence. Yes, he wanted to be a national broadcaster. He wanted to be Jim McKay, Kurt Gowdy, you know, Ray Scott, who did football in that time. That's what he really hoped for, but he was removed from the NBA, and he was just probably 10, 15 years too soon, you know, for his time, where they just didn't really have prominent Jewish announcers on a national stage.
And the other big irony is that HBO gave him a national break because he was their first, in the 1970s, when HBO was starting to come of age, he was their first sportscaster. He was their Jim McKay.
Yes, however, people have to again remember the times. We're talking about HBO now from 2013 perspective, but HBO back in the early 70s was originally just to be able to get, you know, if you lived in a place that couldn't get a television reception, HBO allowed you to get television, and it was primarily at the beginning an all-sports station, and Marty was brought in, and not just was the first person on the air, but he created the programming. There's a real fun part in the film about, you know, all this cheesy programming he had to put on just to fill up 24 hours, you know, on a new television station. But Marty Glickman, you know, when he started, he brought in, you know, NBA, NFL, and Olympic programming, bringing in all his friends to help him, Red Auerbach with basketball. And Marty Glickman started inside the NFL. It was a local show in Philadelphia, and he brought it in. He actually wanted Joe Namath to be the original host while Joe was still playing, but Joe didn't do that, and that show is still going on. It's now on Showtime, but many years later, he brought in Jesse Owens for a special Jesse Owens Returns to Berlin. And more importantly, Marty Glickman did something as a television executive at HBO. When he was there, before he did what I'm about to tell your audience, when you saw golf and tennis coverage, it was only on weekends. They didn't show the Monday through Friday events that were going on. They just showed the weekend. Marty said, look, NBC's doing Wimbledon on the weekend. Why don't we, HBO, become the midweek broadcaster of tennis from Wimbledon? And this sounds so simple, but it had literally never been thought of by anyone. And he brought over the HBO tapes and showed them on a day, you know, they had to be flown over, and there was a one-day delay. But he literally changed the landscape of sports and television as we know it today.
And now the latest Wimbledon, all live, all on cable.
But it
was HBO that created the daytime coverage and the coverage in between the first and second week and the quarterfinals, et cetera, et cetera. They set the platform.
Yeah, especially for Wimbledon. I mean, they raised the viewership of that tournament in the United States tremendously.
We have a few more minutes with James Friedman. He is the writer, producer, director, and narrator of HBO's new documentary special, Glickman, on the life of the great sportscaster, both radio and television, Marty Glickman. The program runs tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time on HBO, repeated throughout the next few weeks on HBO and HBO2 in various day parts. James joins us live from Los Angeles on Tomorrow Be Televised. If you want to get involved in the conversation, do so now at 1-646-652-2906 or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. We won't be with you a week from today because of Labor Day, but we'll be with you 24 hours later on Tuesday, September 3rd, starting our September to Remember, and our first guest on our special Tuesday edition, the former head of Warner Brothers Television, Eric Frankel. We'll talk to him about where he sees TV going as we head into this fall season and beyond. What's his thought about Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, all these television networks getting the scripted programming? Ultra HD, other technology advances, and a brand new advertising adventure that he is involved with some of his colleagues in the TV industry. Eric Frankel, former head of Warner Brothers Television, that's next Tuesday, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, here on Blog Talk Radio. Another milestone that Wickman accomplished in his lifetime was getting the first female play-by-play person on the air. That's Gail Siemens. Tell us about that.
Well, it was actually conceived by Mike Weissman of NBC Sports as a stunt for ratings. These things were usually the end of the year and a game people they didn't think would tune in too much. He did a similar thing. He had a silent broadcast with no broadcasters. I don't know if you remember that.
I remember that game, the silent game. Oh, yes.
Yes. So Marty Glickman was the announcing coach, the very first network announcing coach in existence. And they wanted Gail Siemens to do this, and so Marty coached her, and they did a practice game that only they heard, and he helped her. And, I mean, think about this. To this day, she's still the only woman who's ever done a play-by-play of a football game in the NFL. To this day. I hope that will change soon, but he helped work with her, and she was an anchor at the time and in TV news and ended up keeping that job because she knew it was secure, and that's why she didn't continue on. But, you know, she said, I mean, in the documentary that, you know, at the beginning, Marty wasn't really in favor of this, and he, you know, quickly learned she was serious and trying to do a good job, and he helped her tremendously, basically teaching the basic tenets he teaches everyone, which was on radio, constantly give time and time of the game, the down, yardage, you know, just keep repeating. Don't talk too much. Say what's prevalent and feel the game. Because, you know, Marty was this great world-class athlete, and no one knew about it because he was so modest. He didn't talk about it when he broadcast. But it really helped him feel the game. He used to say when Joe Namath scored those touchdowns with the Jets or Frank Gifford with the Giants, it was as if I were scoring those touchdowns. It was like a little kid broadcasting the game, but a little kid who had a tremendous professional work ethic.
You've been interviewed quite a bit over the last couple of weeks by a number of the sports talk radio stations here in New York, WFAN, ESPN Radio. What's your thinking about those interviews? What questions did you love answering from the likes of people like Tony Page, who's, I think, the best sports talk host and the most thoughtful sports talk host here in New York and around the country. And were there any questions that were real curveballs for you?
Yeah, I had one, which was who would be comparable to Marty Glickman in another field that we would know? And no one had thought to ask me that question. I wish I could remember who asked me that now. And I thought about it, and in the moment I came up with someone. And it's going to seem like a very odd comparison, but it really isn't. I actually told this to Martin Scorsese, who doesn't know anyone in sports. He's completely, you know, he doesn't know anything about sports. And he said, yes, it's perfect. And the person I came up with comparable to Marty Glickman is Marlon Brando, because Marty revolutionized sports broadcasting the way Brando did acting, in the feeling of everyone who followed Glickman and followed Brando did it the way they did it after they came on the scene. And I that was always a very interesting question to me.
James, where do you want to go from here? Do you have any plans to do another documentary special for television or maybe do scripted filming? Where do you see yourself
A bunch of ideas, and I never really love talking about things till they're completely solidified because I feel like I'll jinx it or something, but I want to do stories about people who not only overcome great obstacles, but who give back and help people. You know, I want to champion that. I have two young boys, and when we talk sports, unfortunately, you read the papers today, it's not sports. It's DUIs, it's steroids, it's attacks on women. You know, Marty Glickman represented the joy of sport, and I want to show, you know, people who really give back in a great way. Also, if I could mention, for people who want to follow this more than just on HBO, which it premieres tonight at 9 p.m., you can follow me on Twitter at Glickman the Film and on Facebook on Glickman the Film, and my website's glickmanthefilm.com. There are some clips on the website from the movie if you don't get HBO. There are pictures of Marty. There are stories. And You know, I'm very, very honored and proud to be able to show this film. We just had the premiere in New York, Syracuse and HBO. They gave the first Marty Glickman Award to Bob Costas, and we did a panel with Marv and Bob, and it was so well received, and it played in the theaters in New York and L.A. for a week, and I got a chance many times to see it at festivals with an audience. And what I walked away with was, this may have a sports backdrop, but this film plays for people who know nothing about sports. I mean, that's how Scorsese got involved. It plays on such an emotional level because of the incredible life Marty Glickman led and how many times it intersected with history on a major scale. And that's what I'm most proud of. You don't need to know who Marty Glickman was, and you don't need to know anything about sports to enjoy the portrait of this man in the film.
Well, one thing I hope you do need to know before you see this movie on HBO or down the road is that this was someone who lived a great, full, rich life as a sportscaster and was as innovative as anyone around and is still considered one of the deans of radio and TV sportscasters. This is a film that I highly recommend. I haven't seen it, but I'm looking forward to it, but I highly recommend it because someone who grew up listening to Marty Glickman on New York Giants and the New York Jets broadcast for so many years, very, very special person, and you'll find out why tonight. Starting 9 o'clock Eastern Pacific Time on HBO, the film is Glickman, James Freeman, the writer, producer, director, narrator, Martin Scorsese, the executive producer. Check your local listings where HBO is available in your area on cable and satellite. It will also be replaying throughout the next few weeks on both HBO and companion channel HBO2. For more details about the program online, here's where you go, www.hbo.com. James Freeman, the writer, producer, director, narrator of Glickman, thanks again for joining us. Good, great fortune. Thank you so much for making this film. Good luck with its success. I know it's going to be big and huge, and it will be a great testament to Marty and what he accomplished in broadcasting.
No, thank you so much, Simon. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome, James. All the very best. Take care.
Okay.
James Freeman from Glickman joining us live from Los Angeles. And now it's time for our regular weekly feature, the classic trivia question of the week. We'll give you the question. If you have the answer, email me at simonapple04@yahoo.com. simonapple04@yahoo.com. And lo and behold, in the trivia question dealing with HBO. 30 years ago, HBO presented its first made-for-television movie. Actually, it was the first movie made specifically for a cable network. And the film, like Glickman, had a sports background. Our question, what was the name of HBO's first made-for-television film? What was HBO's first made-for-television movie? If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. That's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Please include your name and where you're emailing from. If you're first with the correct answer, we'll highlight you on Friday's program. And if you have a classic television trivia question you want to stump our Blog Talk Radio listeners with, use that same email address. And if we use the question, of course, you get the credit. One more time, where you go, simonapple04@yahoo.com. If you missed today's question, you can find it tomorrow morning on my Facebook page and also at my Twitter hashtag at UBCSimonTWBT. That's at UBCSimonTWBT. This is Tomorrow We Televise. We are the radio program all about television. We're with you Mondays and Fridays, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio. And if you want to catch up on recent episodes, we've had some wonderful people on. Just check out my homepage, www.blogtalkradio.com/televise. It's www.blogtalkradio.com/televise. And check out our podcast. You can download it on your smartphone or tablet. Take us on the go anywhere you're traveling. Just go to iTunes.com and pick it up. When we come back, a quick up segment on Million Second Quizzes, Computer Woes. And then our next interview, joining us live from Toronto, Canada, Jeff Vandewall. He is the producer of Investigation Discovery's new series, Surviving Evil, hosted by Chris McCarver. It premieres this Wednesday night. We'll get to all of that after we pause after the bottom of the hour for web identification. This is the place to discover what the world has to say. www.blogtalkradio.com. More than 40 million listeners around the world every month and growing. It's your home for the place for talk radio for fine minds. It's the Hallie Castor Jane Show. Catch you Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, weekly on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, that's VTR 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to Tomorrow We Televise on a Monday afternoon here in August 2013. Simon Applebaum here with you live from New York. Happy to have you aboard. Want to get involved with our next guest? Give us a call, 1-646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name, guest 1310, and our friend Rick Webb from Philly are already in the room. Before we get to our guests, a quick up as an update segment where we follow up on stories and topics and guests that we've had on recent episodes of this program. On Friday, we had an exclusive interview with Stephen Lambert. He's the creator and executive producer of Late Second Quiz, which is 2 weeks from tonight at 8 p.m. on NBC. During our program, we had a pair of callers, one from Alexandria, Virginia, outside Washington, D.C., one from somewhere else on the East Coast, who had concerns about the computer application for Million Second Quiz that a lot of people are using to play the game at home and possibly become contestants. Well, they were having all sorts of issues, some wrong scores and not being able to get in on the app. Well, Stephen Lambert was quite concerned about that, and he promised those callers that something would be done. Well, something has been done, thanks to the folks at NBC.com, and we're happy to tell you that we checked in with their Facebook page, and whatever was upsetting those callers has been resolved. So now you can get on NBC.com, get that Million Second Quiz app, and play along as the game gets ready to go on NBC 2 weeks from tonight, September 9th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and as we take away for the West Coast. And that is our up segment for now. Wednesday night at 10 o'clock, Investigation Discovery premieres their latest series. It's a series that is designed to empower people. It's called Surviving Evil, and it's about people who have had horrific crimes in their lives and live to tell the tale. The program is narrated by Charisma Carpenter, the former co-star of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel on UPN, and then later the CW, who herself was a stalking victim. Joining us live from Toronto, Canada, where the production company Cineflix Studios is located, producer Jeff Vandenwald. Jeff, great to have you.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
How did Surviving Evil come about?
Well, it's a show that we were working on for quite a while. I mean, we were Cineflix has done a number of documentary series for Investigation Discovery, and this was an idea of sort of doing something that is about empowering people and looking at what happens to people who actually survive these crimes, not necessarily killed, but live to tell the tale. And it was actually executives at Investigation Discovery had heard of Charisma's story and knew sort of loosely what had happened to her. And so we sort of got in touch and began working on this concept for the series that really looked to show how these people manage to survive these horrendous things and what happens the way they come out the other side.
How tough was it to get Charisma first to relive her experience and then second be the host of this and showcasing other people's experiences?
It's a good question. I mean, I don't want to speak too much for Charisma. I know she, from the very beginning, from the outset, has been an incredible supporter of what we're trying to do. She's been 100% on board and really a valuable member of the entire team of trying to do, you know, trying to find ways that we can tell these stories and try and find ways that we can really present them in the most positive light. And she's been a huge help for all of that since the first day. And I actually was the one who did the interview with her and did the filming with her when we talked about her story. And, you know, of course it's very difficult. I mean, it's a horrendous, horrible thing to have to get through. And for anyone, I mean, these are the worst moments of people's lives. But at the same time, I think, you know, you come through them and you get a sense of understanding, a little bit about yourself and how you were able to survive these things. And I don't, you know, certainly don't want to put words in her mouth, but I think Charisma was empowered by it too. She's a very, very strong, you know, super bright, capable woman. And I think going through something and surviving something as a younger woman has certainly informed, you know, her life and how she's lived since then.
And just to give a complete picture for the audience, we are talking about people who have been the victims of abductions, of kidnappings, of being held for ransom in their homes, stalked, raped, in some cases unspeakable crimes, and yet managed, often without outside resources, without the police, without anyone else, you know, coming to the rescue, how they were able to overcome their captors or their abductors and then getting on with their lives.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you're looking at. And you certainly have stories that, you know, are so amazing that you know, if it was fiction, you almost wouldn't believe it. I mean, one of our stories has to do with a young woman who was from a very troubled home and was essentially suicidal and was abducted by a gentleman who happened to be an incredibly prolific serial killer in Florida. And not only did she survive her interaction with this man, but she was smart enough to plant evidence and keep track of clues and do everything that she could so that when she was able to engineer her own escape, not only did she survive it, she then led the police back to him. And this was, you know, the story of Bobby Joe Long. And it was really because of what Lisa McVeigh did that he saw justice. I mean, I think the police who were involved in the case and the ones that we certainly featured as part of the documentary say that, you know, she really helped us catch him. So all of these stories, they're incredibly thrilling, and, you know, they're the kind of thing that if they weren't true, you know, you almost wouldn't believe it.
What's the big point that you want viewers to get along the lines of there and the grace of God not go I compared to the people that you document, where it was a case of, you know, there for the grace of God, I'm still here?
Well, I mean, I think in all of it, the important part for us was that we wanted the audience to see that people have this kind of power within them, you know, even if they don't necessarily know that it's there. And for me, I mean, these are terrifying tales at times. And so to see that people are able to survive them and that they come through them and that they are, you know, made stronger as a result, I think can be an empowering thing. And for us, that was really the lesson of the series, is that, you know, we're looking to understand how these people were able to do it and really see what that's like for them. And that, in many ways, led to how we made the whole series. It taught us how we should present the show. You know, it's very much told from their perspective. It's very much about understanding in a sort of second-by-second way what was going on with them to see how they were able to survive something.
Surviving Evil is the program that premieres this Wednesday night, 10 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time on Investigation Discovery. Jeff VanderWaal is one of the producers of the program. He joins us live from Toronto, Canada, this half hour, live and exclusive on Blog Talk Radio. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York as well. And we invite you to voice in on the program. All you got to do is give us a call, and that number you use is 1-646-652-2906. That's 1-646-652-2906. The number's good anywhere. Catch us across the country or around the world here on Blog Talk Radio. You can also get involved by using our chat room. Simon Apple 04 by name is a good friend Rick Webb from Philadelphia is doing. And we hope you, if you're listening, take advantage of that. And while the program is on the air, you can connect it with others by using Facebook Timeline. Just click on that Facebook icon somewhere on the Blog Talk Radio screen you've got, and then follow the instructions, and other people can hear this show live with you. Friday on the program, Renee Lawless. She is the co-star of Tyler Perry's popular new Oprah Winfrey Network series, The Have and the Have-Nots. It's the new Tuesday Night Drama that every week gets more and more people watching and talking. Renee Lawless of The Have and the Have-Nots. She's our lead guest on Friday's program. On the second half of the program, we will have Zhao Dubois. He is the chief executive officer of the new network, EVOS Television. It's all about sustainable living, but the only way you can get this network is if you have a smart TV set or you get an over-the-top device like Roku. Can this network do what Planet Green couldn't do? We'll find out about EVOS. That's Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Once you determined the cases you were going to cover, how long did it take for you and your crew to put the episodes together?
I think we were probably working on the show for about a year from start to finish overall. The way we sort of did it is we were looking for stories and looking for, speaking with people. And for us, we also wanted to really partner with people who wanted to tell their stories. I mean, this was something that it would really only work if the people that we featured wanted to express something and wanted to tell it. So we would, we'd find our stories. We went out and we shot our documentary aspect of it, and then we did some of the recreations that you'll see at, you know, sort of after the doc was shot. Once we had a strong sense of exactly what the story was, we put those together. But it was about a year in total from beginning to end to do all 10 episodes.
Ultimately, how did you find the cases? Did you do a lot of checking through Yahoo and Facebook and Google and social media? Did you encourage ID listeners, ID viewers to come up with leads? How did you find the people?
It was a combination of all of those things. We had a large research department here in Toronto working, and we would look through news stories, things that had been published, books that have been published. But yeah, trying to get the word out through social media and various parts of the internet to have, you know, people who knew people reaching out, even at times speaking with police departments and people who are involved and getting their perspective on things of someone that they might know who they think might be a good candidate as well. We try to reach out to as wide a group as we possibly can to sort of find all the stories.
Of the 10 episodes you've done, what was the easiest episode to put together and on the flip side, the toughest?
Oh, that's a challenging question. I mean, they're all... I'm sure it's a bit of a cliche, but they're all sort of their own individual challenges. I think that Lisa McVeigh's story, Lisa McVeigh was the woman who was kidnapped by a serial killer and managed to survive, was in some ways one of the easier ones to put together simply because because it happened when it did, which was sort of in the 1980s, there was a lot of material available. We could read about it. There was a lot of stuff to sort of wrap our heads around it fairly quickly. And it was such a compelling and just riveting story that it, seeming from my perspective of putting it together, seemed like we were able to grasp it quickly and move ahead. Stories that had challenges, I mean, were stories often where, for us, it was more about just trying to make sure we were going to do it all justice and make sure that it was all going to be as you know, really compelling as it should be, and that we would really do it to the level it was supposed to be done. And I know that with Elizabeth Shove's story, which was one of the ones that's going to air, you know, in the first couple of weeks, about a young woman who was held actually in an underground bunker, we were all just so committed to the story, and you know, we spent a lot of time talking about it and a lot of time being really concerned that we just got it right, that you know, she was a very young woman when it happened. And so that, it wasn't a sense of it was difficult to make, but that for us, it was really just something that we wanted to ensure we got right and that we balanced the tone of everything that happened in an appropriate way and was able to tell the story appropriately and also not be too dark or too horrendous or any of those things that you know, you don't want to dip into it too far. And so I remember that.
Yeah, but that episode, by the way, Jeff, when you read about this, reading it from the press release, this is a girl who was abducted, had a bomb strapped to her body, and then was dragged to this underground bunker in South Carolina. And goodness knows, this person was like abductor was like a madman.
Yeah, and it's literally a nightmare. I mean, that's what it is. And so when you're trying to tell that story, there's a certain responsibility that I think you have to deal with when you're trying to do that appropriately. And Elizabeth and her family were amazing and incredibly compelling. And so you do feel a sense of pressure and just wanting to get it correct. And I think in many ways, you know, we felt that pressure across the whole series. And I actually think it was a good thing. You know, it drove us to tell stories as well as we could and do everything justice and really do the absolute best job with the material we could, because we really wanted to, you know, do right by everyone who participated. And I think it was a good pressure. I mean, I think it was a good thing to have. But yeah, they're all really disturbing nightmares in some cases, and it's amazing to see how these people are able to survive it.
Jeff VanderWaal is the producer of Surviving Evil. It premieres this Wednesday night, 10 p.m. Eastern Pacific, on Investigation Discovery, one of the Discovery Communications family of channels. Jeff is live from Toronto, Canada. It's the home of Cinefix Studios, the production company behind such programs as Pawn Stars and American Pickers on the History Channel, and Copper, which is wrapping up its second season this summer on BBC America. That was their first scripted effort. And we invite you to be part of the program here on Tomorrow We Televise on this Monday afternoon, final Monday of August 2013. Simon Applebaum live from New York. All you got to do is call us. The number you use is 1-646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Again, we won't be with you a week from today because we want you to enjoy your Labor Day weekend. So we will be with you a day later, 24 hours later, same time and place. That's Tuesday, September 3rd at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. And our lead guest will be Eric Frankel, the former president of Warner Brothers Television. He's got a lot to say about where TV is going and also about a new venture that is advertising-oriented and could be a television situation. Eric Frankel, the former head of Warner Brothers Television, he is with us a week from Tuesday, week from tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, right here on Tomorrow We Televise. And we have a September to Remember coming your way on the program. Some of our guests coming your way during the month will be one of the presidents of the Oprah Winfrey Network, Eric Logan. We'll have the new executive producers of the Scripps syndicated series Let's Ask America, the 7 o'clock game show, Michael Cannon and Jeff Kravitz, the hardest-working game show executive producer in the business from The Price is Right and Let's Make a Deal, our good friend Mike Richards, and the executive producers and creators of Bones on Fox, Hart Hansen, and Stephen Nathan. They're all among the guests coming your way this September to remember right here on Tomorrow We Televise. We hope to have some more guest confirmations at the end of the week. What kind of outreach is being done with your program so that people who might face or have faced this situation, like the people you profile, can get counseling and guidance?
Well, I know, you know, Investigation Discovery is doing a number of those things through their broadcast and looking into it. And certainly it's something that we do as well whenever we are in touch with anybody. I mean, whether it's this series or another, we're quite cognizant of the fact that, you know, sometimes these people need additional help and need things that they can do beyond the scope of the show because of the, you know, these issues are so severe. But I know Investigation Discovery is working with Charisma, and they have a number of things planned really to continue the outreach, because I think what will happen is that when the show airs, people will see it and will be inspired by it, and it may also touch a nerve with people, or people may realize that they've, you know, been exposed to things that have affected them more so than they thought. So it's certainly something that they're looking to explore going forward.
How's Charisma been to work with?
She's been an absolute dream. I've really, really enjoyed working with her. She's been, from the very beginning, just such a huge proponent of the show, and she's just, you know, lovely to work with, really engaged. And, you know, this is something that for her really means something. You know, she takes it very seriously, and it's something that's very close to her heart because of what she went through. And surviving that attack with her friends and, you know, really helping to see that, you know, rogue police officer, the man who was involved in attacking her all those years ago, was brought to justice, was a big part of her life. And it's still to this day, I think, has influenced, you know, things, the decisions she makes and the ways that she acts. And so this, for us, it's been a great partnership, and she's been wonderful to work with, and hopefully we'll get a chance to do more with her too.
Does this series show a universal way of how people get on with their lives, so-called closure?
It's a good question. I don't know if it's necessarily universal. I think that everyone's different, and I think that people have different experiences, and the way they recover for them is different. I think that, you know, if there's one thing looking across all of the stories you see, is that people tend to be tougher than they think. People are very resilient, and they can surprise even themselves. I think that, you know, everyone recovers differently, and I think that people will heal in different ways. But this sense of a kind of spark inside of us, you know, this thing that you're not going to give up, that you're going to continue, that you're going to make it, I think that's there. I certainly think that's there across the board.
One thing we don't talk about a lot is how events are recreated in television programming. And, you know, it's amazing to think that 25 years ago, the idea of recreation on a regular basis was created by America's Most Wanted, the John Wall series on Fox.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious how the process of recreating events in a dramatic way has evolved since that series got going.
Well, you know, I think it's evolved in a lot of different ways. I mean, for me, our approach tried to be very specific and tied to our subject matter in our show. I mean, you can choose all kinds of different approaches for how you want to do things, and we really wanted to stay sort of true to what we were trying to create. And so for us, a lot of it was about trying to get inside those moments, you know, really trying to get into those seconds of action and understanding what people are thinking and what they're feeling and how they're trying to get through it. And so that kind of approach to the storytelling informed how we then tackled our recreation. So it made things like slow motion and still photography and that kind of stuff all the more important. And it also helped tell us sort of what's, you know, what are moments that are important for us to recreate and what are moments that we don't necessarily need to visualize in specific, and we let that be a bit of a guiding light. And, you know, we talked about all kinds of touchstones. I mean, we talk a lot about Errol Morris, who, you know, I think is sort of obviously a phenomenal filmmaker and documentarian, and things like he did on Thin Blue Line and those sort of approaches. But we also talk about horror films like Halloween, you know, and how you're able to create suspense by actually not seeing things and not showing things. And we've tried to sort of cook all of those ingredients together into something that I hope serves the stories and serves them in such a way that it makes for compelling viewing. But it wasn't, you know, I don't think there's necessarily one approach working now. I think there's a lot of people doing different things. But for us, that's how we all tried to sort of work and cook it together.
Have you started to gather material for season two?
We have a little bit, yeah. I mean, we did a little bit of work at the end of season one of keeping track of stories. I mean, as I'm sure you know, when you're researching this, you're looking for as many stories as you can find and as many great stories as you can find, and you're reaching out to people and beginning conversations. And so we continue to do that a little bit even as we had our sort of first 10 stories and to just keep some in the vault in the hopes that we may be able to do more of these in the future. And you know, I'd also hope, too, that people see it on Investigation Discovery. They get a chance to see the show and see the kind of programming we're trying to do, and certainly see Charisma's story. And they may then want to talk about their story. You know, that it may actually encourage people to want to share their stories and say, you know, I've got something that I think could help people too. You know, I came through this. This was this horrible thing, and I lived it, and I think there might be value in telling it too. And we may even get some that way.
You know, your show is going on a week after the reappearance of Hannah Anderson, who was abducted on the West Coast. And then, of course, a couple of weeks before, the surfacing or resurfacing of those three girls after a decade in Ohio at the hands of Ariel Castro, who was later tried and sentenced to an incredible prison term. You know, so many lifetimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the one thing that you see is that there's these sorts of stories appear, and I think, you know, on one hand, if you look at it from a sort of darker point of view, you're shocked by the prevalence of violence. You know, you're shocked by, like, oh, my God, how can this happen and how can this exist? And I think there is that element to it. I mean, you are continually shocked by what we seem to be able to do to each other and the outcome. But I think the flip side of it, too, is that you get there are also these stories of survival and the fact that you do not give up hope. You know, what happened in Cleveland with the Castro story is absolutely shocking. And the fact that they survived it for the length of time that they did, you know, is almost unbelievable. But I think that, you know, the good that can be taken from it is that notion that, you know, you don't give up. People survive it and they can get through it.
The program is Surviving Evil. You can find it on Investigation Discovery. The premiere is this Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time. Check your local listings for Investigation Discovery is in your area via digital cable or satellite. For more details about the program online, you go to investigation.discovery.com. That's investigation.discovery.com. Once again, Surviving Evil premieres this Wednesday night, 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time on Investigation Discovery, a member of the Discovery Communication family of networks. Chet Vanderwall, the producer of the show, thanks again for joining us live from Toronto. All the very best to you. Good luck. Let's hope this is a great run. But even more importantly, that it shows that people can thrive beyond the horrific things that they, through no fault of their own, get into. And that hopefully there, in the grace of God, we have people that can avoid these tragic situations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Same here, Jeff. All the very best. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
Jeff Vanderwall, producer of Surviving Evil, joining us live from Toronto, Canada. In a moment, some comments on two people who passed away, both in the acting profession, over this past week. And last night's MTV Video Music Awards live from my borough of Brooklyn. And yes, no, Miley Cyrus promise. We'll get to that, but first we're going to pause briefly near the top of the hour for web identification. This is Internet Radio at its very best, www.blogtalkradio.com. More than 40 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Catch the best of ETR 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to Tomorrow We Televised. Simon Applebaum here with you live from New York. Happy to have you aboard with us on this Monday afternoon. We'll have some news about our upcoming guests, but first, some comments. Over this past week, two actors at opposite ends of the scale passed on. One was one of the great actresses of the 20th century, Julie Harris. She passed away over the weekend at the age of 87. She was one of the most awarded actresses of all time. 3 Emmy Awards, 5 Tony Awards, another Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement in Theater, and several Oscar nominations and Golden Globe nominations, too. And at the other end, there was Lee Thompson Young, co-star of Azolian Isles. He died a week ago in Los Angeles, shot dead, gunshot wound to the head, suicide. More on Lee and what we could learn from his passing in a moment. But first, more on Julie Harris. When Julie Harris appeared on any stage, whether it was television in the 1950s and 60s, whether it was on the Broadway or off-Broadway stage or in films, there was always a glow about what you were going to see, because Julie Harris had that kind of radiant, glowing presence that had you feel you were going to see some very special event. That's the kind of actress Julie Harris was. And Julie was one of the first actresses on a regular basis to showcase empowered, empowering, complex, unique women. Indeed, Julie made history both in stage and film with her first major performance when she played a 12-year-old tomboy in Carson McCullers' The Member of the Wedding, opposite a great supporting cast, Ethel Waters and Brandon DeWills. She repeated that performance on film. She won an Oscar nomination for it. Frankly, she should have won the Oscar for Best Actress for that incredible role. Not too long after, she played the girlfriend who switched allegiances of brothers in Elias Kazan's East of Eden, starring James Dean. And then came her great TV career on the Hallmark Hall of Fame, the DuPont Show of the Month, and other marvelous anthology shows and specials of the mid-late 50s and early 1960s. Again, when Julie Harris performed, millions of people watched because they knew they were going to get a terrific performance and get a major event. She was, let's say, sure thing at the bank for any television producer working with her. She won 3 Emmy Awards. 2 of them were for Hallmark Hall of Fame productions in 1960, Little Moon of Albany, written by the brilliant playwright James Costigan, who was a frequent collaborator, by the way, on Harris productions, and Victoria Regina a year later in 1965. In the 1980s and 90s, she played the mother of one of the lead characters on Knots Landing. And in between, she did shows for PBS. She was in marvelous plays like The Belle of Amherst on Broadway and then later adapted for television and just kept on with winning after winning performance. Julie Harris kept on performing until near her death this past weekend. As I said, she died of congestive failure at the age of 87. She was an extraordinary actress who made any television, any film, any Broadway or off-Broadway or stage play she was in worth catching, because of just her presence. She wasn't the greatest, most beautiful person in the world. She wasn't the greatest looking person in the world. But boy, the woman could act and act great. She ended up being, I think, one of the great television role models of the early days of the medium, and still is one of the great actresses and role models of all time. Julie Harris, she passed away. She lived a great life. And thank goodness that a lot of her performances have been captured on videotape and film for all of us and many more generations to enjoy. And then, after our program Monday, we learned of the suicide death of Lee Thompson Young. He was just 29 years old. In the 1990s, the mid to late 90s, he was the first star of the famous Jet Jackson, Disney Channel's first sitcom, which paved the way for so many more. A great string of them, from Lizzie McGuire to That's So Raven, today's shows like Ant Farm and Shake It Up. He was the first star of a Disney Channel sitcom. He did not let stardom go to his head, as he showed in many a film, many a supporting role on television as well, and more recently is one of the co-stars of TNT's hit drama, Rizzoli and Isles, one of the top summer dramas in television. When word broke out about his suicide, Janet Tamaro, who is the executive producer of the program, who was on this show a year or so ago, said it tremendously. The staff, the cast, the crew was beyond heartbroken at what happened, because you would not believe seeing to a key among that crew, you would not believe that Lee Thompson Young was ever thinking about suicide. He was a game player. He was the kind of person you wanted to see on a production set. He was someone who was ready to go at all times, great with the cast, great with the crew, the kind of colleague you wanted to be with on and off the set. There was no sense that he had suicidal tendencies or thoughts of taking his own life prematurely at the age of 29, not even making 30. There is something to learn, I think, from Lee Thompson Young's death and how he died, and it's this. We've got to find a way, many ways maybe, to reach out and reach people like Lee who have thoughts and demons of taking their own life. And sad to say, he is the latest of several people over the last few weeks, young talents like Corey Monteith of Glee and that woman from That 70s Show who somehow made life a premature deal by either suicide, by mixing drugs with alcohol, or by mixing drugs that became lethal. There has to be a way, I think, to reach and reach out to these people and say to them in one way or another, this is not the way to go. Life is worth living. Suicide is not the way to go. And it is not, like the MASH song says, painless. Some of you may know that for nearly two decades, I've been involved with Landmark, the Empower Education Program that's offered around the world, the people who do the world-famous The Landmark Forum, which more than 2.2 million people have done over the last 22 years and change. One of the basic principles of Landmark is this, that anything, no matter how dire, how tragic, how consequential it can be handled in communication. And that communication starts when people have the willpower, the incentive, the initiative to take what they need to say, what they need to deal with out of the brain, out of the mouth, and out into the open where we can deal with it. No, we cannot read minds. Most people can't. But what we can do is we can react and deal with it once we encourage people to get what is on their mind off the mind and into our space. If there's something that we can all learn from Lee Thompson Young, it's that we've got to be greater. We've got to be more vigilant. And if we see any sign of anybody having an issue with their life, that we get involved. We don't leave it for the next person. We get involved and we encourage people to take whatever actions they need to take to face those demons and overcome them. And they can be overcome. Whatever demons Julie Harris had in her career, and goodness knows there were some, she faced them. And she became one of the great actresses and actors of the 20th century. And her work, as I said, will live on for generations to come. I hope that the work that Lee Thompson Young did in his too brief life, his too brief existence on this planet, will be seen by other generations. And more importantly, that other generations will take this lesson from him. It's that when those demons that he faced face you, you don't need to go his way. You don't need to take a gun in your hand and blow your brains out. There are better things in life. Even when you're facing the craziness of life, there are better things in life, and there are people to reach out to. I hope that's the lesson we learn from Lee's brief existence on Earth. And to both of them, rest in peace. And finally, some comments about last night's MTV Music Video Awards. First of all, it was great to see these awards happen in Brooklyn, and Brooklyn looked quite great, whether it was those wonderful lead-into-commercial shots of Brooklyn neighborhoods, or whether it was Katy Perry singing her new single, Roar, below the Brooklyn Bridge. If you had a high-definition television set or an Ultra HD set, you saw one magnificent picture. Katy is, I think, a very special performer, and she showcased Brooklyn in grand style. No wonder it was a wonderful finale. And in fact, Brooklyn was the big winner of the MTV Video Awards last night because people got to see a borough that has really come flying in the last few years, and particularly in the last year since the Barclays Center was open. Barclays was sparkling. Everybody was up for the occasion. Even some of the craziest moments, Barclays looked and played great. And I'll tell you something, it makes you think, hey, MTV, if Brooklyn is so good last night, how about bringing this to Brooklyn the next year and the next year and the next year? How about it, folks? Let's start a movement to make Brooklyn the permanent home of the MTV Video Music Awards. There are a lot more movement to give out in the years ahead, so let's get them out in Brooklyn. It's my borough. I'm no apologist for it. It's a great place, and like Barclays Center showed last night, it's a great home to make permanent to the MTV VMA. So let's start a movement, folks, and let's make it happen. Oh, and one more thing. Let's also create another movement to put more creativity in music videos. We had Steve Barron, the legendary director behind such videos as Billie Jean by Michael Jackson and Take On Me by A-ha and Money for Nothing from Dire Straits on this program a week ago in conjunction with the new movie he did for Reels Channel, Delete. He's absolutely right. We need to get the creativity back in the music video field. Yes, there are some people who are keeping that creativity alive, like Lady Gaga and Katy Perry and Justin Timberlake, etc. But we need more of them behind the scenes, directors, writers, creators, choreographer, to not just do same old, and just put the star in front of the camera and let them do their thing. Again, in the 1980s, what was so great about MTV and watching music videos was that every video was an event, and every video seemed to advance the creativity of where the medium could go. And given the fact that so much technology out there, microcams, mini cams, steady cams, advanced in computer animation, flash animation, etc., live action, so much more can be done with music videos than they are being done now. So let's also put a movement together for more creativity in music videos, more experimenting, more taking chances, more taking risks. I bet you the audience for them will grow. And the next time a network like MTV thinks that, well, maybe we shouldn't have music videos a big part of our schedule, they might just think again. Friday on Tomorrow Be Televised, Renee Lawless. She is the co-star of The Have and the Have-Nots on the Oprah Winfrey Network. You can catch her tomorrow night on that network, Tyler Perry's first drama, doing great, audience growing by the week. Renee Lawless will join us in the first half of the hour. And on the second half of the hour, the head of Evox Television, the new network aimed at sustainable living, Zhao Dubois will join us. Remember, you can only get this network on smart TVs or using over-the-top devices like Roku. And then next Tuesday, our post-Labor Day edition, my lead guest, the former head of Warner Brothers Television, Eric Frankel. That's all coming up this Friday and next Monday right here on Tomorrow We Televise, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. If you missed any part of today's episode or you want to catch up on previous shows, all you got to do is go to our homepage anytime, 24/7. That's www.blogtalkradio.com/televise. www.blogtalkradio.com/televise. And you can catch us on our podcast at iTunes.com. Download us to your smartphone, tablet, and take us on the go wherever you travel. Spread the word to others as well. Great way to do it on podcast. We'd like to hear from you. What do you think about our guests? What's your thoughts about where TV is at, where it's going? Well, we have a big year to hear what you got to say, so go ahead and say it. Use my email address, simonapple04@yahoo.com. simonapple04@yahoo.com. If you use it, please enclose your name and where you're emailing from. That's how you give us your answer to today's classic trivia question, or give us a possible show to know for an upcoming episode, or just some general thoughts about our guests and the future of television in general. Once again, simonapple04@yahoo.com. You can also use my Facebook page or my Twitter hashtag to get your views across. The Twitter hashtag is at UBCSimonTWBT. That's at UBCSimonTWBT. Remember, we really appreciate what you have to say. It's important. You make the program go. So what you say matters, so go ahead and say it. We're listening. The views we've had on this program are those of the participants, not necessarily those of Blog Talk Radio. Our production associates are Amy Domestico and John Sweet. The creator of Blog Talk Radio is Mr. Alan Levy. But tomorrow will be televised. I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for listening. Have a great rest of your week. We'll catch you back here Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, with Renee Lawless of The Have and the Have-Nots and Zhao Dubois of the new Evox Television Network. Again, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, you know where. Blog Talk Radio. Until next time, stay well and stay tuned.